Hey, Spencer.
Hey, Chris.
How are we doing today?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Fantastic.
How's all the snow treating you?
It's great. I love it. I think I'm doing a better job this year of embracing winter and I'm actually getting excited about all the snow falling. Historically, I would have been, just thinking about shoveling and how much work that is and how sore my back is going to be. But I don't know what it is. I flipped the switch this year and really embracing it. I think you have to if you're going to be a lifer in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that'll definitely make it easier. Today's a big day.
It is a big day.
Double digits.
Oh.
10th podcast.
I actually wasn't sure why it was a big day, but it always is though. So. Episode 10. First, before we get into the meat of the show here, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this Yarn transition to TypeScript.
Yeah, just kind of came across the issue that was opened, it looks like, just about an hour ago. That is kind of laying out the future of Yarn in version 2. And it looks like it's going to be ported from Flow to TypeScript. And it looks like one of the reasons they kind of mentioned was so that it was easier for contributors to start contributing to it, which I think is kind of interesting. But it's also kind of beneficial, I guess, to us since we use TypeScript. The better community support there is, the more packages are written in it and have better typings that are accurate. So I think it's kind of cool from that perspective, but also kind of interesting that they're switching to it. And one of the things that highlighted is that so it's easier for contributors and not really necessarily like the language itself or any of those aspects.
Yeah, I think the reason I was most shocked to see this is just the fact that, this is a Facebook project. Well, as far as I know, it's largely driven by Facebook engineering. And given they are the primary users and maintainers and creators of Flow, it's just interesting to see them adopting TypeScript and kind of admitting, I don't know, it feels to me like they're kind of admitting defeat here a little bit in adopting TypeScript and abandoning Flow. And I wonder what that kind of means for other projects, or if even development around Flow, if they're thinking of combining forces and kind of, scaling back their investment there, or what the future is.
Yeah, definitely. I'm also curious, I guess, like the research or rationale that kind of went into the knowledge that switching to TypeScript would make it easier for contributors. I wonder if that's like based on hard facts or if that's just like an assumption of like basically those JavaScript surveys, those yearly surveys of like what technologies are you using, like what languages and things like that. I wonder if it's based purely off that and that there's just more people using TypeScript, so therefore more people know it and more people can contribute, or if there's like other aspects that come into play there.
Yeah, I thought of the same thing with the surveys. It definitely seems like TypeScript has dominant, market share or mind share, whatever you want to call it, compared to Flow. For anyone who's looking for type safety in JavaScript, the ecosystem does seem to be a lot more active, a lot more going on there. But I mean, as someone who isn't actively using Flow, I'm probably unaware of a lot of the developments around that and in that community. I'm glad. It feels like we made the right choice, at least adapting TypeScript and in favor of Flow. And yeah, I mean, obviously, we're really happy with the choice. So, and I'm very excited to see more projects being written in TypeScript to begin with, and even things like this where, rewriting things in TypeScript, and even from Flow to TypeScript. It's kind of, I don't know, to me, it's really surprising to see that, but I also just very excited about what this all means for TypeScript and the ecosystem around it.
Yeah, for sure. It would have been interesting to hear the internal conversation of like that decision, because it's, I'm assuming, no small task to rewrite all of Yarn. Although it probably isn't terrible porting from Flow to TypeScript, because you already have some level of typing, so it might just be more syntactical than like an actual rewrite, but I don't actually know. Maybe it does mean entirely rewriting everything from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to think there's some code, code gen, something that's going to take care of most of these transformations for them. But because I mean, the type definitions themselves and everything, I'd imagine, you know, they're not that different than how you would define things in TypeScript. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Another interesting thing that is in this issue is it says Yarn is going to be designed to support different install targets than Node, which is interesting, I guess. It would be, whether or not it would be good to do, but I think it would be cool if between, like, right now we have our Rails and our like front end Webpack project, and we have to run bundle install separately from Yarn install, and they kind of have different like nuances and things you have to be aware of. It would be nice if you just ran one command and it installed all of your dependencies across both, like the Ruby, Rails, gems that we need, and the Webpack or Node modules that we use. But kind of curious also if that would be useful, or if that would maybe be another challenge. But
yeah, I'm excited to see progress in that area too. I think there was maybe talk a while back, I'm not sure whatever happened with it, but like RVM2, there was like this big rewrite that was going to happen, and there was a lot of I feel like that was kind of the vision for that project. But yeah, I'm excited to see people trying to make progress in that area. Cause yeah, I think it's definitely been caused some friction on our team. You know, people, I think either forget to, I mean, it's really easy to forget to bundle things, really easy to forget to, I mean, bundle install it for Ruby, like install all of our dependencies. And then on the JavaScript side, remember to run Yarn install, and you get these cryptic errors. That's not obvious. I think on the Ruby side, they tend to be a little bit more obvious what's going on. But yeah, I'm optimistic that I think the tooling can improve a lot there. And yeah, it just is a continuous like source of issues for us, and I'm sure for every team. And yeah, the less things people need to remember to run on a regular basis, the better, I think.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. That would be very cool to see. I think the last small thing I noticed in here that there's a lot of other things in here. I just am not fully aware of everything you can do with Yarn, or like haven't had the need to use a lot of these. So a lot of them don't mean a lot to me. But one last thing that recently came up with kind of working on our design system and having the separate repository is linking between packages. So like running Yarn link in the separate design system repository, and then linking that package in the main repository to kind of like test out those components before we merge them. Today that is managed somewhere. I have no idea where, but when you run Yarn link, it just like provides you a message like this was successfully done. Then you got to remember to unlink it, or it's going to continue to point to that package. I'm not really sure of the nuances there, but now it looks like they're going to actually persist those changes in package.json under the link dependencies, which I think will just be a nice little win to actually see what packages you have linked locally versus not linked.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know, honestly, there's a lot that stands out to me in this document. It's all very high level at this point. But like the Yarn becoming an API and becoming more modular, I think that's actually a really interesting thing. They're developing like a plugin system, which I think, those two key changes, like making, like being able to plug into the, well, being able to tap into like that plugin API, I think is going to be huge. Like we've seen a lot of things become possible in Webpack as a result of that. I'm really interested to see what people are able to do with the Yarn API. And then also there's a note here about this becoming a development first tool and trying to be more plug and play. I think that's an interesting idea too. Like they say something about like you should never have to run your package manager on production servers. Here's the actual quote. The more code run there, the higher are the probabilities that something will eventually go wrong and bring your production systems down. Yarn being development first means that we'll make it possible for you to reach the state where you clone a repository and voila. This includes putting the emphasis on plug and play, which has been designed with this specific use case in mind. So it sounds to me like, you know, dependencies just land in the repository, or you're able to clone those down with the repository somehow and not have to worry about, you know, depend on, say, a lock file. I'm not sure what role that's going to play anymore with that kind of plug and play setup, but I'm interested to see how that evolves. And I definitely get what they're talking about here with, you know, sometimes it seems like, you know, even with the lock file, I think the other day I just like blew the lock file away and I just ran yarn install again and I got a totally different lock file. I think this will be interesting to see how it eliminates, just gives us more consistency in predictability around package management and how, especially if this ends up being, you know, that we can carry this over into managing dependencies for in other languages too.
Yeah, for sure. That would be awesome. Yeah, I'm kind of curious how, I guess, what this means or what the actual implementation details of just cloning a repository and then having all of the package dependencies that you need. It almost sounds like, I guess, just like checking them into the repository, but I'm assuming that's not what they mean because that's kind of almost like a, I guess, regression to where we would just include all of the vendor assets directly into the repository and then any changes would make a big Git diff change, and it would be a little messy that in that perspective, but it would be kind of nice just thinking about like our container builds and when we build our production images. It does take quite a bit of time to install all of those yarn dependencies. So if it was included somehow in the clone process, that would be pretty cool to cut out that step of having to install those dependencies and also kind of eliminate any networking issues that are just kind of like random and cause the container image to flake, and just rebuilding will fix it. It'd be cool if that somehow eliminated that entire step from the process and was able to make that a lot faster.
Yeah, this is the first I've really come across this whole plug and play strategy that Yarn provides. Apparently it's been out since September of last year, but yeah, something I hope to play around with a little bit in the near future here. It sounds like it's something you could already do today, but it's going to become more the default going forward. So yeah, lots of interesting things to keep tabs on here around Yarn.
Yeah, for sure. I also didn't realize the plug and play was already a thing. Kind of want to check that out now, because I think one thing that I was talking with some people about recently, it was just that I think you already actually mentioned the exact issue where kind of when you start the Rails server, it like hard crashes if you have a like gem missing or the incorrect version, but with Yarn, it'll just keep running, and like the Webpack build will probably start spewing errors if like something doesn't exist in the node module because you didn't run Yarn install properly. So I wonder if we could write a plugin basically that would just not allow you to run Yarn run some command if the package installed in node modules doesn't match the Yarn lock version. I think that would be nice to kind of hard air rather than today where we kind of soft air and people are confused. Like, is this something locally just for me? Did I forget to do something? It's not usually immediately obvious that they just have to run Yarn install to get like the most updated package for whatever error they're seeing.
Yeah, that sounds like a perfect use case for what they're moving towards with the plugin API. But, well, you ready to switch gears here to the main topic for today?
Yeah, definitely.
So at Handshake, we've been using Mocha and Enzyme and Chai for testing components for the last year or so. But we recently pulled out all of our shared components to a separate package. And we wanted to take the opportunity to try out some new tools there. We did an entire episode on this a few episodes back. So make sure to check that out if you're interested in that whole, how that whole process worked. Spencer also wrote a good blog post about this that you can find on the Rubber Ducking publication in Medium. But one of the big changes we made around testing in this new repository or this new package is we reached for React testing library instead of Enzyme, and then we're using Jest to run our tests as well. So Spencer, I'm curious to hear your thoughts now after having a chance to work with this new tooling for last month or two. You know, what are your thoughts? What are some of the key differences? What do you like, dislike?
Yeah, I think we still have probably a fair amount of like just trying to use it and seeing how it works left to do. I think I have like maybe the minimum amount of like kind of experience working with these new technologies, but so far they've been interesting at least, but I think also have kind of helped shape the way I kind of think about testing components and have led to what I think are better tests for our components. But it is a little bit kind of a unique case where we're just testing like design system components that are for the most part relatively presentational, and they're not very complex like stateful components that like dispatch requests, have to do things async. So the complexity of the tests are relatively simple, but I think there's at least one or two examples so far where the benefits, or at least the like mentality of how you should be writing tests in these frameworks, has definitely changed a little bit as I've been writing these. I think like the first big thing is you said we run Mocha, and now we are using Jest for our design system tests. I think Mocha has worked fine for us, but it does seem like it is more like broad use case in the sense that it can run almost like any type of like no JavaScript test, which is nice. But then there's like a lot of kind of config upfront and a lot of things we have to manage. We have to kind of like stub out a lot of things. But then with Jest, it seems to be a little bit more opinionated in the sense that there's like a lot less config, but it also seems to fit really well with testing React and components. And maybe that's just due to the fact that Jest and React are both maintained by Facebook, and they kind of evolved together, I would guess. But just like one in Jest has like a few other nice benefits of like snapshot testing, which we've kind of been experimenting with a little bit and seeing how that works for us. But I think the biggest difference is basically the whole pitch of what React testing library is that it requires you to think about how a user is going to interact with your component, whether that's like a actual user on your website, or if that's like a developer user and what that prop interface should be, rather than reaching into internals and testing implementation details. And like I kind of mentioned, that doesn't really change a lot for presentational components. It's kind of the same, but we have a relatively complex component that we ported over, and that's the first time I was kind of like, well, I really have to think about these tests in a different way. So we have like the standard card component that is pretty popular probably in most design systems, that just kind of renders a card with content in it. And then sometimes we want to make that entire card clickable, but we also have several links within that card. Usually it's like a job card, and you can click on the job and go to the job, or you can click on the employer and go to the employer. And maybe a few things are linked. So we can't really make the whole card clickable just by wrapping it in an anchor, because now we have nested anchors and that's invalid HTML. So we kind of stub this out by creating a card linked component. You just wrap the entire card in this, and then it programmatically triggers the correct anchor when you click on it, and adds all the necessary like attributes so that it's accessible. And somebody on our team wrote that and did a really great job of that. But then testing that is obviously not an easy task. And there's a lot of like internal logic within that component that's like searching for the anchor, programmatically clicking it, making sure it works with like query params, hash params, without anything. Like all of those types of things. And when we first just like cut and paste that over, all of the component implementation was entirely fine. We were able to keep that as is, but then the test had to port from like Mocha Enzyme to Jest and React Testing Library. And for Mocha, that's basically, it seems Mocha has context blocks and I don't think Jest does. So that's basically just like changing any context blocks to describe blocks and then it's valid Jest tests. But then the Enzyme to React Testing Library is like where the interesting part kind of comes in, because we had quite a few tests that were mounting the component and then calling .instance on them, which is a enzyme helper to get the instance of the component. And that's kind of like one red flag is, why do you need the instance of this component? And it means that you're stuck using a class component. If you change that to a functional component, that test is immediately going to break because you can't get the instance, as far as I'm aware of how that works. So that was kind of the first red flag. And then it was calling all of these methods that we declare as private methods in TypeScript, and kind of testing the return values of those. A lot of those were kind of like Booleans or returning a single element. And writing a test like that with React Testing Library just is not possible. And that's like very intentional. They just do not give you the API to do things like that. So I really had to like actually think for a while, like, how do I actually test this component now with React Testing Library? And I actually thought about it longer and harder than I should have in retrospect, and realizing the test was like, wow, this is a really straightforward test. Like, this is why React Testing Library like is what it claims to be. So basically just ended up putting a click handler on the anchor that I was expecting to be clicked within the card linked component, and then just asserting that when the card link component was clicked, that anchor was programmatically clicked or it wasn't clicked, and just the various edge cases there. So I think that was the one example so far of the differences between Enzyme and React Testing Library.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And it's cool to know that it's kind of worked as advertised so far. I'm curious to know, has it influenced how you write tests outside of React Testing Library in any way? Has that carried over to, you know, how you're testing things in Ruby or in our existing, you know, Mocha and Enzyme tests?
Yeah, I don't think I've actually written too many Enzyme tests since then, but I'm definitely going to be thinking, like, if we had to port this to React Testing Library, which I think is maybe its own topic, but something I would definitely be worth talking about maybe. But if we had to port this, like, would this basically just be like renaming these methods and making sure that it's compatible with React Testing Library? Or would I have to fundamentally rewrite this test because it's like reaching into internals and things like that? So I think it's definitely going to influence how I write Enzyme tests. And I'm probably going to actually think, like, does this method or identical functionality exist in React Testing Library? And if not, maybe I shouldn't be using it because it's probably an implementation detail. So I'm definitely going to consider that. But I think React Testing Library, just like, rather than suggesting the best practice of don't test implementation details, it almost forces you to avoid implementation details and pushes you closer and closer to how the user is going to interact with it and write more robust tests that you can refactor the underlying component, and assuming that it still adheres to the same like user interface or API prop design interface and implements the same functionality, it'll still work.
Yeah, I know I've been cringing every time I see the instance method called in our tests since adapting a React Testing Library for our design system. Yeah, that's something I'm going to try to avoid too. But you also shared a podcast from React Roundup where the creator of React Testing Library, Kent Dodds, was interviewed. And he talks about some of the motivation and kind of his journey, you know, with testing so far. And I thought he had some really interesting insights in that, you know, something that they talk about in there is this test idea of the testing pyramid. And I think that's made up of the foundation is unit tests. The middle layer is, I forget, but then, you know, integration tests are further up. But like the general idea is, you know, have a lot of unit tests and have not as many integration tests, because the more expensive a test is to run, the less of them you should have. He kind of said that he doesn't really agree with that whole model, which I think, you know, having coming from a Ruby and Rails background, that is something that was always kind of really ingrained in me. A lot of the thought leaders in the Ruby community really talked about those types of things. But I think, I mean, just thinking about how the tooling has evolved and how, and maybe even in Ruby and Rails, it's still, you could still make that argument. But that's only because of the tools that exist there. You know, using Capybara to, you know, spin up a browser and create a bunch of records in your database and like click through the app, that is still very expensive. But thinking about just testing React components, this is more of like a integration level test, or they feel a little bit more like that. And, but you don't have the, they're not as expensive to set up. And even some of the full, like integration testing frameworks like Cypress and stuff that actually simulate, well, I mean, I guess all these simulate things to a large extent, but I mean, it'll actually like spin up a browser and, click around and everything, give you some nice debugging tools. I think just it kind of comes down to the actual developer experience you're able to achieve. And if you can minimize the costs of creating those kind of integration level tests, and like you said, you know, simulating real user behavior and making sure the system actually responds with the appropriately, a lot of those, that foundation of unit level tests doesn't really feel as important to me. But yeah, I mean, it also, so I mean, I guess as we move more towards, you know, single page app and get a lot more of our logic into the client from the server, I think this becomes more of a possibility for us. But thinking about how expensive it is to execute and maintain some of our integration tests and Ruby and Rails right now, it's just not exactly the case. So I think it's, yeah, it's been interesting. It's definitely evolved my thinking around how we test React components, but I think it's also going to influence how I think about testing in general in other areas as well. So one of the things that you mentioned is snapshot testing, which is kind of a new capability for us with these new tools. Where do you see that fitting into how we write tests today? And is it going to replace tests that we were writing a different way? Or is it just another layer of coverage that we're going to be able to tap into?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually haven't like looked into the details or kind of like, I guess, the best practices around snapshot testing. And I'm not entirely sold that kind of the default built-in snapshot testing for Jest is going to deliver a ton of value. It almost feels a little bit like it's kind of an implementation detail of like, does it have the exact same HTML attributes? Is it a span versus a div, which like doesn't really matter. But in the snapshot testing, if that changes, that's going to fail that test. So I'm not certain that it's going to be a great fit. I think maybe one example of where it might make sense is we have the button component, which can accept both a onClick handler and an href. And if it only has an onClick, we want to render a HTML button element. And if it has an href, we want to render an anchor element. And I think that that might be one example of where this snapshot testing might be useful to make sure that it's rendering the proper HTML, and any refactorings of this component doesn't change that underlying like switch between the button and an anchor. But kind of beyond that, I'm not certain that it's going to be super useful, because it's really testing those implementation details. And I think like a span versus div is kind of one example of that really probably shouldn't be failing a test. Maybe one level above this with like visual snapshot testing would be more useful, where like the span versus div doesn't matter unless it actually changes the visual of the element specifically in our design system. I think would probably be a more robust test, in the sense that like the implementation of this component does not matter at all. It can be a span, a div, a button, whatever you want, but if it has the same padding, the same border, same margin, like it's fine. So I don't think we've invested in that yet, but that's something that I think maybe would be a little bit more useful than this like HTML snapshot testing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it's actually an interesting kind of parallel to what we've been talking about with like test the actual behavior of the system rather than the implementation details. I think, you know, whether it's a span or a div, kind of an implementation detail, but having kind of a visual regression testing, I see a lot of value in that. Because then you can actually know, like, is there user-facing, you know, impact of these changes, and how different is it? So yeah, I'm interested to explore that layer, maybe in tandem with some of the new capabilities we have with snapshot testing. But yeah, I definitely think that is going to provide a little bit more value for us.
Yeah, for sure. And kind of just faced this recently. I actually don't know if you would be able to snapshot test this, but we accidentally removed the cursor pointer on the card link, so it was not showing the proper cursor when you hovered over it. Not sure if that could have been caught by snapshot testing, or if we have like the capability of like triggering hover and focus and things, but that could be another interesting thing, especially for accessibility, to ensure that there's no regressions in like the focus or hover states.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. I'm trying to think how we would test that. At one point, it almost feels like an accessibility test that you'd want to write, but it's not actually a clickable, you know, it's not a link, it's not a button. You're just adding a click handler. So yeah, that's a tough one. I'm not sure what the right answer is there.
One other thing that I thought was I guess kind of cool, but also kind of useful is React Testing Library kind of has this idea of a test ID. So you just have like data dash test ID equals something, which I think kind of sells this idea that class names shouldn't really be used for testing, because class names are for styling, and the styling is more of like a visual implementation detail, not necessarily like how the user interacts with it. So as long as the like element is still accessible in the test, like changing the class name, changing something like that shouldn't really affect it. And we actually already have that concept. I think you introduced it with data hook, which we kind of use in both our component tests as well as our like end-to-end tests with CopyBar, which I think is kind of cool to see that this was something that's first class supported by React Testing Library, and it's a pattern we already are using. And it was reassuring, I guess, that it is, I guess, by React Testing Library standard, a good practice to do. I think now it could start to get a little confusing that we have this thing called hook. Now React has a first-class feature called hooks. So I'm sure a few people will get confused when we first mention that, oh, just use a hook here for testing, to be cleared.
Yeah.
Clear about that.
Yeah, the test ID is a much better name. For much more clear what that is for than the hook. I totally stole data hook from Spree is an open source e-commerce system for Rails. And they used those data hook attributes in a lot of the testing they did. And for a while I was contributing like plugins and stuff to that. And that's where I picked that up. But I definitely like test ID. Let's as a community agree data test ID is what we're going to call that going forward.
That's funny. I mean, hook isn't a bad name. You want to hook onto the element and write some tests around it. But yeah, can now see where that can get confusing, I guess.
Yeah.
Although for us previously with our previous test, it was difficult to even select, at least in our component test with Enzyme, it was difficult to select on class name, which was both a good thing, but sometimes a bad thing, because we use CSS modules and that was just challenging. But nice thing with Jest now is that we can just add in a plugin, a polyfill of some sort, so that when we're using CSS modules, it just puts the name of the key there and doesn't do any of the like CSS module namespacing or like, or any of the like auto-generated names for the class names. And we can actually test then to make sure if we want to, that proper class names at least added visually in our test, if we have some sort of like internal logic for switching between different class names, if different logic or for different states.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That was one of the things that I think has been really nice about the transitions, you know, using Mocha, and then we use JS DOM to kind of provide a browser-like APIs, you know, fill some of the things like, you know, the window object, and all the things that are you normally have available with and you might interact with in your components. One of the problems we've always had with that is, you know, CSS modules don't get processed and class names just become null. So you can never actually check that, you know, a certain class is applied or anything. And a lot of times it's hard to know, you know, is this, what state is something in? You know, it's that's where you end, you know, is it green or is it red? And that's where you sometimes end up reaching into the instance of the component and checking the actual props that were passed in and things like that. But yeah, it sounds like now, you know, with React Testing Library, we can actually get the class name before it's transformed, you know, what we actually write in the style sheet before it's processed by CSS modules, which is a nice win.
Yeah, for sure. This is definitely going to be nice. Do you have any other thoughts on React Testing Library, enzyme, component tests, integration tests, any other tests, Yarn, feature of Yarn TypeScript?
No, I think that's all I've got for today. Interested to see how we think about migrating or adopting React Testing Library, assuming we continue to enjoy using it in our design system, how we might migrate some of our tests in our code base today. That seems like a pretty daunting task right now. Maybe something we can talk about in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, show notes for this episode can be found at rubberducking/10. If you have any thoughts or feedback, hosts@rubberducking.fm.